raging across Gaza.
There's very heavy fighting in Gaza. Israel is continuing to fight both in the north of Gaza and in the south. The north is mostly empty of people, although not completely.
A surge of mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo has scientists worried about a global outbreak.
What we're seeing now in Democratic Republic of Congo, more severe form. Now we're seeing a little bit of a difference in what we've traditionally thought about transmission and maybe some additional concerns in regards to new mechanisms or new modes. And now we need to understand what the impact is.
And Israel helped Cyprus foil an Iranian-ordered attack against Israelis and Jews on the island. Today is Monday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Israeli tanks battled their way to the heart of Khan Yunis on Sunday in a major new push into the main city in southern Gaza, as health authorities in Hamas-run Gaza said about 18,000 Palestinians had been killed in the war. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein, who gives us this update from Jerusalem.
So there's very heavy fighting in Gaza. Israel is continuing to fight both in the north of Gaza and in the south. The north is mostly empty of people, although not completely. And in the south, in Khan Yunis, there are very heavy sort of, you know, almost hand-to-hand combat in some places, which is, you know, this is something relatively new. Until now, Israel hadn't seen that. Israel says it's killed 7,000 Hamas fighters, approximately, but there are still at least another 15,000 believed to be in Gaza. At the same time, there was a video shown of several dozen Hamas fighters. They were their clothes had been taken off, their shirts, and they had their hands tied behind their back, and they were Hamas fighters who had surrendered to Israeli troops. And Israel says that Hamas is starting to lose its will to really fight Israel. I'm not really sure if that how widespread that is or if that's really happening, but the death toll in Gaza continues to rise. The Palestinian Health Ministry says more than 17,500 people have been killed, a majority of them women and children, and close to 50,000 injured, and large parts of Gaza have been totally destroyed.
Linda, we've talked about this in the past, but UN agencies are saying that there is no safe place for the Palestinians to flee. Some observers, including UN officials, are worrying that Palestinians will be forced out of Gaza altogether.
Well, the thing is that the only two places they could go if they were to be forced out of Gaza are Egypt and Israel. Now, in terms of Egypt, Egypt has been fortifying its border. It's made it very clear it has no intention of accepting any Palestinians from Gaza, and has said that if Israel does force people into Egypt, that would be the end of the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, which, by the way, is one of the most important components of Israel's national security strategy. It's had a peace treaty with Egypt since 1979, the Camp David agreements. And so I think Egypt's made it very clear, and Israel has no intention of letting them in. And the Palestinians themselves don't want to leave Gaza. They say that in 1948, some 700,000 Palestinians left what became Israel for Gaza and the West Bank, and they have no intention of doing that again. The problem is it's not clear where people can go and where they can go to be safe. So as I said before, there is this strip of land called the Moasi, which is about 8 miles long, and Israel has said that people can go there and it will not be bombed. They've also said that there are 150 UN schools that they won't bomb. But I think, in fact, one of the reasons, that you're seeing these hand-to-hand battles is because Israel is not using airstrikes in the south as much as it did in the north after it told people to leave. So when the north was relatively empty of Gaza, they used these airstrikes. But now any airstrike is going to kill civilians. But I know that the situation in Gaza is just chaotic, and people are absolutely terrified. I've spoken to people in Gaza in the last couple of days, and they just say they don't have anywhere to go. They're terrified. There's not enough humanitarian aid getting in. It's a very difficult situation.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Sunday that Israel helped Cyprus foil an Iranian-ordered attack against Israelis and Jews on the island, and that such plots were on the rise since the Gaza war erupted. Netanyahu's office gave no details of the planned attack, but said in the statement released on behalf of the Mossad Intelligence Service that Israel was troubled by what it saw as Iranian use of Turkish-controlled northern Cyprus, both for terrorism objectives and as an operational and transit area. Amid growing criticism over its continued support of Israel's military operation in Gaza, the United States defended its stance Sunday, but also reiterated the importance of protecting Palestinian civilians. Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
More forcefully, with intensity. That's how Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described Sunday the advances of his troops in Gaza.
In order to achieve all our goals, the elimination of Hamas, the return of all our abductees, and the promise that Gaza will never again be a threat to Israel.
Netanyahu also thanked the United States for vetoing a UN Security Council resolution last week that would have called for an immediate ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained the decision when interviewed Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
With Hamas still alive, still intact, and again, with the stated intent of repeating October 7th again and again and again, that would simply perpetuate the problem.
As Blinken stressed the importance of providing Israel the support and weapons it needs to defend itself, he made it clear it is not without conditions.
Those rules apply to Israel as they do to any other country, including the way they're used and the need, the imperative of respecting international humanitarian law.
But as the civilian death toll continues to rise in Gaza, the United States' stance has been strongly criticized at the Doha Forum, which is held every year to discuss world challenges.
It's not up to Israel only. It is those who have given the Israelis the greenest of the green light to continue killing the Palestinians.
In the United States, we had a very blunt conversation with Secretary Blinken. All of us, the Arab and Muslim delegation, were very clear. Our priorities are set. Stop the aggression, allow sufficient humanitarian supplies into all parts of Gaza, ensure protection of civilians.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, also a forum participant, said he'll continue appealing for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared. And from Geneva, the chief of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned about the impact the war is having on the health environment in the Gaza Strip.
As more and more people move to a smaller and smaller area, overcrowding, combined with the lack of adequate food, water, shelter, and sanitation, are creating the ideal conditions for disease to spread.
He noted his organization has deployed teams to support health workers on the ground who are physically and mentally exhausted. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. West African heads of state on Sunday officially recognized the junta in power in Niger, but said their sanctions to reverse the July coup in the country would remain even as they initiate steps for a short period of transition to civilian rule. Iran on Sunday held the first hearing for a Swedish citizen who was detained last year on charges of spying for Israel, media reported. A report by the Mizan Online IR news website, which is affiliated with the country's judiciary, says that the prosecutor accused the man, who was identified as Johan Flodiros, of having links with Israeli elements and gathering information for Israel. In a meeting of the leaders of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, a grouping of East African countries, both Sudanese generals agreed to an unconditional ceasefire and resolution of the conflict through political dialogue and to hold a one-on-one meeting, the bloc said in a statement Sunday. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Many Egyptians headed to the polls Sunday for the first day of a three-day presidential election in which four candidates, including President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, are running. El-Sisi, who has held the top post since being elected in 2014, is widely expected to win. The election comes as Egypt faces serious economic problems and outside pressure from the conflict in Gaza. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
A festive mood prevailed Sunday as residents in Cairo's upscale Zamalek neighborhood watched people lining up to cast their ballots outside a polling station. Observers from several political parties stood outside to keep tabs on what was taking place. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly cast his vote in Egypt's new administrative capital early Sunday. The government built the new capital outside of Cairo and is trying to move its ministries and institutions there. Madbouly told journalists that he was pleased to be voting in the newly built capital, which was just a dream on a map not too many years ago. He says that hundreds of people are outside the polling station in the new capital, exercising their right to vote, adding, "We are all working hard to build a better future for our children and grandchildren." Egyptian state media showed President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi casting his ballot at a polling station near the presidential palace Sunday morning. Sisi has served two terms since he was first elected in 2014. A constitutional amendment passed in 2019 allows him to run for a third term. Khattar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the three candidates running against President Sisi are weak. He says that none of the other candidates running against the president has much weight, so the election is more of a referendum on the president's popularity, and that given the current regional and international conditions, everything seems to be weighing in favor of Sisi's remaining in office. He says that the stability of Egypt remains important for the future of the Middle East region and that no one really wants to see any disruptions in Egypt for the time being. Saeed Sadiq, who is a professor at Egypt's Japanese University in Alexandria, told VOA that the security situation in the country is weighing heavily on most voters' minds now and will likely influence their decision.
Before the 7th of October this year, the main issue was mainly economic. People were not happy with inflation, rising prices, rising foreign debt, which is over $166 billion. And then the 7th of October occurred with the idea that they will transfer Palestinians into Sinai. So the issue of national security began to overtake the economy.
Israel vowed to destroy Hamas, which governs Gaza, after the militant group sent fighters rampaging into Israel on October 7, killing around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, according to Israeli tallies. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
Ukraine pushes for more global support as Russia's president says he will seek a fifth term in the Kremlin. Kyiv's bid to join the European Union seems frozen as its troops prepare for another winter at war. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Ukrainian soldiers again ready for winter combat, blanketed by the snow-covered fields of western Poland. The exercise takes place in underground trenches, simulating the fighting soldiers so far have faced, even if most of these trainees have never seen combat, according to one of the Ukrainian soldiers here. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to Buenos Aires to attend the inauguration of new Argentine President Javier Milei. Zelensky was there to shore up support from the global south for Ukraine's ongoing war with Russia. Before his trip and from Kyiv, Zelensky recently signed bills into law, one specifically to appease Hungary in a bid to clear a path to Ukraine's EU membership. One of the biggest roadblocks to that membership is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who recently met in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron. Orban recently appeared in a televised interview from Hungary's capital, Budapest. Orbán repeatedly said he opposed Ukraine's membership in the EU, saying it would take 5 to 10 years to first conclude a strategic partnership. Orbán is considered one of Europe's top allies of Russian President Vladimir Putin, as well as a spoiler for Ukraine's EU membership, as the 27-nation bloc requires unanimous approval to absorb a new country. Meanwhile, at a Friday ceremony in Moscow, Putin awarded soldiers who fought in Ukraine while announcing he would again seek the presidency in 2024. If, as expected, Putin wins re-election, that would keep him in power through at least 2030. The 71-year-old Putin has already served longer than any Russian leader since Joseph Stalin. But just outside, in the streets of Moscow, the political team of jailed Putin opposition leader Alexei Navalny was already at work creating billboards with a seemingly innocuous New Year's greeting. The message, however, contained a QR code that took viewers to a Not Putin website. Authorities soon removed the signs, and Navalny continues serving his more than 30-year prison sentence. In Ukraine, a push to erase all traces of Russian rule. Municipal workers took down the statue of a field commander from the Russian Civil War. A local councilman said it would now live in a museum. In Ukraine's Kharkiv region, this modern war wages on as a recent Russian missile strike killed at least one person and injured several others. According to CNN, Western intelligence assessments warn Russia is likely to increase such attacks on civilian infrastructure during the winter. And while civilians brace for more cold months at war, frontline soldiers fight to regain land in the country's south and east. VOA cannot independently verify the date or location of this video from Reuters, but Ukrainian forces say it shows the latest push to recapture cities like Bakhmut, seized by Russian forces this spring. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden has invited Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to a meeting at the White House on Tuesday to discuss the ongoing war against Russia and the vital importance of continued U.S. support of their defense efforts. A surge of mpox in the Democratic Republic of Congo has scientists worried about a global outbreak, with at least 500 deaths linked to the virus this year. That's more than the number recorded last year when mpox was declared an international and U.S. health emergency. Jason Kindrachuk, associate professor at the University of Manitoba's Max Ratty School of Medicine, Medical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the threat of global mpox outbreak never really went away.
I think for us, you know, last year was a bit of a warning sign, right? So we saw the virus get outside of kind of the traditional borders where it's found, moved very rapidly to new geographic locations. We were able to suppress cases, but they're still ongoing. I mean, in some areas, and then we kind of forgot about mpox. I think from more from a kind of a public standpoint, this should serve as a bit of a reminder that, you know, that this disease has not disappeared, and certainly we don't understand everything about it. Last year, we had the benefit, I think, a little bit in the sense that we had a less severe form of monkeypox virus that moved globally. And what we're seeing now in Democratic Republic of the Congo, more severe form. Now we're seeing a little bit of a difference in what we've traditionally thought about transmission and maybe some additional concerns in regards to new mechanisms or new modes. And now we need to understand what the impact is.
For the first time, scientists have identified sexual transmission of a version of this mpox virus that's linked to more fatalities in a place where, you know, mpox is endemic. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, you know, last year was a bit of an alarm signal for us, right? We suddenly saw this surge in mpox globally, you know, a little bit of a new flavor in terms of the type of monkeypox virus from what we had seen previously. But we had all these clusters of cases that were related back to sexual contact. Maybe transmission, we don't know for sure. A lot of data points to that, but definitely close sustained contact. And there was this over-representation within those that identify as gay, bisexual, or other men who have sex with men. which was different from what we had seen previously. Now we have this small cluster of cases in DRC, too small at this point to make a lot of assessments on whether or not the epidemiology follows with what we saw last year.
That's a little more scary, isn't it? Because we're not talking about infection from animals. We're talking about human to human infections.
Well, it is. And there's this piece of saying, okay, is this new? Or is it something that we had missed previously? And that is always kind of the piece that I think we try to contend with of, you know, has the virus changed? Or are we now seeing a bigger picture of what the virus can do because maybe we're looking or more attuned to a different type of presentation of this disease? Again, last year, presentation of Mpox, very different from what we had seen historically. Now we have to kind of look at this disease with a little bit of a new lens and say, okay, in endemic regions, what have we potentially missed? And what does that mean in regard to ongoing transmission and certainly risks for expansion of that virus?
Now, you've seen this in the DRC this year. Are you guys worried that it's going to pop up in other countries too in Africa?
Well, hey, certainly we're looking, right? I think for us, the biggest piece is if we look at regions that are adjacent to those endemic areas, do we see any inference that there has been kind of this cryptic transmission or transmission that's been going under the radar where people maybe have had symptoms that didn't look quite like Mpox and were largely self-resolving or because of stigma, they didn't move forward. What does that landscape look like? Also, from a global standpoint, now that, you know, we certainly have more resources in place to look for Mpox, I think a piece of this is now saying, okay, we can't just shut those down. We have to continue to be cognizant that the virus is still moving.
VOA's Carol Van Dam speaking with Jason Kindrichuk, Associate Professor at the University of Manitoba's Max Reddy College of Medicine, Medical Microbiology, and Infectious Diseases. 75 years ago on Sunday, the UN General Assembly approved the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at a meeting held in Paris. It laid one of the foundation stones of the international order that emerged following the horrors of World War II. The declaration has 30 articles setting out fundamental rights and freedoms, and it was proclaimed as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
December 10th is World Human Rights Day, a date chosen to honor the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of one of the most influential documents in modern history, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Today, this document turned 75 years old. Precipitating from the events of the Second World War, it was the first global enunciation of the inalienable rights of humankind. Horrified by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations, the United Nations General Assembly, without delay, began to work on codifying a set of universal human rights. The final document is based on the premise that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, as explicitly stated in the first article. The declaration, which came into force in 1950, inspired the development of international human rights law, as well as the International Bill of Human Rights. Today, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the world's most translated document. Since 1950, then, December 10th has annually been celebrated as Human Rights Day. To commemorate this important achievement of the United Nations, at the time barely 3 years old. On this day, the Nobel Peace Prize is formally handed over to that year's winner. And every year, the observance is dedicated to a different aspect of human rights. This year's theme is Consolidating and Sustaining Human Rights Culture into the Future. On Human Rights Day and during Human Rights Week, we remember and reaffirm the sacred idea that every person is created equal, endowed with inherent dignity and inalienable rights, said President Biden in a written statement. This idea was at the core of America's founding. And today, this idea beats in the hearts of millions who march, fight, and sacrifice for the innate liberties we deserve as humans. Around the world, from China to Burma, Afghanistan to Iran, Ethiopia to Ukraine, and beyond, courageous people are standing up to abuses of power, staying strong amid threats to their lives, and speaking out against violations of their fundamental freedoms, said President Biden. The United States stands fully with these brave women and men fighting for their basic human rights in the face of oppression and injustice, and we always will.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.